You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 10. Embedded deep inside the problem itself of getting rid of hate speech is sort of a
what is hate speech?
A flaw that this problem can't be solved in the way that we're hoping it can be solved.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Well, I did it. The 10-episode challenge is complete. This is when I challenged myself to get started with 10 episodes and see how it goes, and then work to further refine this podcast. I learned a lot along the way. First, I learned that people really want some topical discussion, and I could do that in a unique way through the lens of my own experience. And that's what we're doing today when we talk again about Facebook and the moderation problem. I learned that it's okay to podcast on my own. People will listen to these solo shows. And also the interviews are great. So most of what I tried, I think, worked. I can be a little more flexible, which is basically what I wanted. I think I figured out how to tie the topics that we talk about here to the theme of the show. The Local Maximum, that's the name. That means that you're going to try to search for new ideas or try to find out where your old way of thinking is holding you back. And it's also an idea in machine learning about how to get our AIs to be more flexible as well. So I'm going to continue to interview people with interesting perspectives. I'm going to continue to talk about emerging technology and the promise it has for the future of humanity. And I'm going to continue to analyze current events from the unique perspective of a machine learning engineer. And that's what we're going to do today. Last week, I spoke about why Facebook and Twitter and YouTube are not able to solve their moderation problems, and it came from their basic approach to the problem. Assuming that there is a ground truth for this kind of content moderation, having people flag stuff and then teaching the machines to identify that stuff. Well, guess what? I listened to Mark Zuckerberg's testimony in front of Congress the following day, and he said exactly that. He confirmed exactly what I just said. He thinks he'll be able to solve the problem in this manner directly, but in 5 to 10 years. Now, I get it. Running an online social network of 2 billion people around the world is a gargantuan task, but they've adopted before, and I think they'll adopt again, and maybe within those 5 years, they'll have to take a different approach. To analyze parts of the Mark Zuckerberg testimony, I bring on my good friend. All right, Aaron, welcome to the program again.
It's a pleasure to be here, as always.
I've been working on this show for a while. I don't record this out of the studio. Sometimes, like today, I record out of my apartment, and there's been someone singing, I think, upstairs for like 3 hours. I don't know how that happened. Usually, these walls are pretty thick, but not today. So that's what living in New York is like.
We'll keep our ears peeled for some background music.
That might not be bad. Maybe I should go ask my neighbor if they want to sing background for the Local Maximum. You know, how would you like to get an actual gig? Okay, so today we're talking about the Mark Zuckerberg testimony before Congress. I've listened to a lot of podcasts and takes on this. So, you know, if you are worried we're not making the obvious jokes, it's because I've already heard like 1,000 jokes about how this is like, you know, explaining Facebook to your grandparents or whatever. Or when these congressmen say, you know, those young people using Facebook, they really mean like our parents. But I think we're just going to talk about the substance of it. And I'm going to try to add, you know, what I know based on my experiences working on technology that is somewhat like this on a smaller scale. And let's see if we could try to get to the bottom of what's going on.
Yeah, we'll try not to retread too much of the territory that's been beaten to death already.
Yeah, well, it was very interesting. I thought overall he did very well. And obviously came back to the clip, which I know you heard of me last week. And I thought it was very interesting that what I said last week about Facebook's overall mindset, which is that they just believe that they don't have good enough machine learning tools and they don't have enough people on staff to moderate hate speech, is, you know, I kind of questioned their fundamental approach to the problem. And I think that in the testimony, Mark Zuckerberg kind of confirmed to me that that is indeed their approach. So maybe, let me just play the clip and we'll react. Ready?
Let's go.
That's clip number one.
This hate speech is very linguistically nuanced, right? It's, you need to understand you know, what is a slur and what whether something is hateful, not just in English, but the majority of people on Facebook use it in languages that are different across the world. Contrast that, for example, with an area like finding terrorist propaganda, which we've actually been very successful at deploying AI tools on already. Hate speech, I am optimistic that over a 5 to 10 year period, we will have AI tools that can get into some of the nuances, the linguistic nuances of different types of content to be more accurate in flagging things for our systems. But today we're just not there on that.
All right. That was a little bit edited, but just edited for speed, not changing the substance of what he said. So a couple things that are interesting to me about that. He mentioned that there were easy problems and hard problems. He did kind of do that breakdown, kind of like I did the day before. Did you notice that?
Yeah, it's there's definitely some low-hanging fruit that can be caught there. But this is not a simple problem to resolve.
Right. So one of the things that we can do with machine learning very easily is say, okay, we have a bunch of texts that are of a certain type, and I want to find texts that are like these other texts. So for example, he mentioned, I think it was ISIS propaganda. Well, you can write an algorithm that reads, you know, 30 things that are 30 things. Why did I pick 30? I don't know. Let's say let's say a million, or let's say at least a hundreds of thousands, because these are hand-labeled things of examples of texts that look like ISIS propaganda. And then you could write something that immediately picks up on new texts that look exactly like these old texts. And so I agree with him that that's an easy problem.
Right. And that works until the people producing this propaganda, whether it's ISIS or some other organization, realize that they're getting filtered and slightly change their behavior to make it through the filter.
Oh, and, yeah, it's, and then you totally
have an arms race of how fast can we change our behavior and how fast can they update the filter or the algorithm to catch us as we do that.
Yeah, it's totally a adversarial problem, as we call it. And it's totally, like you said, an arms race problem. But it's something that you could win, at least in the short term. And in order to win it in the long term, you have to keep training it and you have to go in on it. But when it comes to hate speech in general, it's not only just this problem on a larger scale, which is what they think it is, but there's kind of a twist to this arms race where it's not like everyone is going to agree on what is and isn't an example of hate speech, where I think you could have people in a room agree what is an example of ISIS propaganda, particularly since the people who are looking at this are, you know, just employees in California. Right? They're just American employees in California. So they all have the same frame of reference. They all agree what ISIS propaganda is. But when it comes to hate speech in general, all over the world, you know, I don't think, first of all, I don't think that people all over the world would agree with that. And I don't think that their particular people and staff can come to an agreement on what is and what isn't.
Well, absolutely. I think At the simplest, if you got a random sampling of people from across the United States into a room together, I don't think they would necessarily agree on what hate speech is. However, it's an even more complicated problem than that, because, you know, if I was going to say I don't know what the legal definition of hate speech is, and so in moments ago I pulled up the Wikipedia page on hate speech, and there are at least a couple of dozen different countries under the listings for hate speech laws by country, and they are each presumably slightly different, if not significantly different. And Facebook, they play in an international world where For someone who's posting from South Africa, do they apply the South African hate speech restrictions, or do they apply the European ones because it's being presented on the feed of somebody in Europe, or do they take whatever the most strict and restrictive of those is, and then how does that play into free speech? And it's, even if you take out the question of whether or not personal biases are coming into play, if you simply look at how do I comply with the law, That's not a simple problem either.
Yeah. And then there's another problem of, like you said, the reaction from the community, the reaction from the people doing the hate speech is they're good. Not only are you going to have different community standards, but people are going to change their words over time. I mean, as some people, you know, like to complain, oh, the PC police change their definition of what's allowed and what isn't over time. And so, you know, hate speech is going to evolve and morph over time, and people will come up with new and clever ways to say things that are offensive. And then other people are going to come up with new and clever ways of being offended by different things. And we're going to see a speed up of this international conversation, which is kind of mind-boggling.
Yeah, you saw a lot of coverage of that type of thing during the 2016 election with all this discussion of dog whistles. And, you know, while someone may not be saying something that is an explicitly racist word or phrase, they're saying something else, which at least to some people in the audience is clearly intended to be a workaround to that. That, well, what they're trying to say is X, but they can't say X, so they're saying Y, but we all know that they mean X. And right. I don't want to get into whether that is a correct assessment, but the fact that that discussion is being had means that there's a lot of depth and complexity to what's going on here.
Yeah, I made the prediction that I don't think that their approach to just try to machine learn this based on examples is going to work. And it's interesting that he gave he gave a timeline, which is, I think, the timeline that people usually give when it's off the top of their head, which is from 5 to 10 years. And I understand, look, you know, I make a lot of predictions, right? And this is because I recognize this because I make the same mistake. If I think something is really difficult and it's not happening, but it should be happening, and I don't know why, I'll often say that, I'll often give that 5 to 10 year answer. And I think sometimes that 5 to 10 year answer just means that it's not a problem that can be solved in a way that I think it can be solved. It's like, well, if there's some narrow AI thing that hasn't been done by 2018, maybe it'll be done by, you know, 2023. Whereas usually that just, like, narrow AI is something that can be done, and it means that there's something subtle about this problem that maybe it can't be done in that way.
Well, so are you saying it's dependent on a breakthrough that hasn't occurred yet, or is that overstating the hurdle?
No, I think it's not that there's a breakthrough that hasn't occurred yet. I think that the problem that he's, the statement of the problem is actually inside the problem itself, embedded deep inside the problem itself of getting rid of hate speech is sort of a,
what is hate speech?
A flaw that this problem can't be solved in the way that we're hoping it can be solved.
Fair enough. Yeah. It's all tangled up in itself.
Yeah. So right now he's got, what did he say? 20,000 people looking through these messages. It's people from, well, I assume they hire people from all over the world, but still, it's a very non-representative sample. I mean, the world look, this is the first social network with what, 2 billion people? So they're finding out that things that work in your local community or even in a single nation with, like, you know, a small set of languages and a shared culture is just not going to work for those 2 billion.
Well, and you've talked on a previous episode about localization, I think is the right term. And I'm sure that at Facebook, they have a significant team focused on that.
Absolutely.
I wonder if they also have teams doing what I might refer to as regionalization, where there's some things where you're trying to make it so that everybody, no matter where they are, can access the information in a way that makes sense to them. But there might be some types of information that you're trying to serve only to a certain subset. And I wonder if that's the type of thing, if they've put much effort into that type of thing, or if that's completely counter to their mission.
Well, they certainly have with ads, but...
Right. The flip side of that coin is targeted advertising, which is very much what got us into this issue in the first place. They weren't being called before Congress because of their failure to limit hate speech. Although that got a lot of airtime, it was some other things that they did that got them there.
It got a lot of airtime because it's probably more interesting, particularly more interesting to to Congress, because they're sort of in the world of trying to track what the national conversation is.
Yeah, and then.
And you could bet all of those people do targeted advertising when it comes to their
absolutely.
Campaigns.
It's a waste of money not to. Why would you serve ads to people who are not at all receptive to your message?
Yeah. Or who are already going to vote for you. That's the flip side to it. You don't want to waste your time on them. Well, you might want to try them to get their friends to vote. But if they're totally on board and you can't get them on board more, then...
Well, this gets to another topic that I think we talked a little bit about gerrymandering in a previous context. But the whole electoral college is... maybe it's not based on the concept of targeted advertising, but it certainly encourages that approach because... broad-based advertising to the nation as a whole, or splitting your message equally across every county or every state, is not an effective way to try and win a U.S. presidential election.
Oh, yeah. And that would be true even if it were a popular vote system, because like you said, you'd want to focus on those median voters.
Yeah, it's that ever elusive undecided or swing voter.
Yeah, just the Electoral College kind of changes where those are.
Absolutely. So one thing that I don't think we've explicitly talked about, we may have hinted at it, and I think it came up in the context of perhaps in the context of Diamond and Silk, which you mentioned in the previous episode.
I'm just going to throw out
one word, and I'm sure we're going to cycle back to this, but censorship. So go on.
Yeah. Right. Well, actually, I mean, I brought up Diamond and Silk as an example of a group who had been recently, censored or banned from Facebook for whatever reason. I don't think they were actually banned. I think that they were just demoted by Facebook. Their impression of it was, Facebook is censoring us for our political beliefs. I had no idea that this was going to come up in Congress. I was watching this, like, one congressman or senator had like a big picture of Diamond and Silk, and he's like, "Do you know who this is, Mr. Zuckerberg?" And he's like, "Yes." And I just pictured, like, as he was preparing for the night before, he had to go through and, like, watch 3 hours of Diamond and Silk clips as part of the process, which is kind of a funny image in my mind. But he answered the questions, and I thought it was very interesting the way he answered. First of all, Diamond and Silk themselves, and I think a lot of conservatives online, feel that they are being personally targeted by the people at Facebook and some of these other social networks, Google or whatever. And I think that when it comes to Congress, they have maybe there is a problem. I would agree that there is a problem. But I think that particularly the way Congress, some of the people in Congress are talking about it, they have a warped view of the way this whole thing's worked. So let me talk about what Mark Zuckerberg said happened, and then we could kind of speculate on how we think this happened. So he said that there was no hate speech in what they were saying. They're just supporting the president. I mean, I think someone literally said, like, is it hate speech for two African-American women to support our president? And he said, no, there's no problem with that. And he said it was.
Yeah, and I think everybody involved in the discussion, except for maybe some very fringe people, agrees with that stipulation. Yeah. That no, nothing they were saying qualifies as hate speech.
Yeah. Although, just like we talk about this, I mean, that's the discussion in this country, right? Now imagine, and we'll get back to Diamond and Silk for a second, but this just came to my mind. Like, imagine someone in Russia says, "Hey, is it wrong for me to post stuff online to support my president?" Or imagine someone in Syria right now saying, is it wrong for me to go online and post something about my president?" I could imagine it won't be as clear cut as soon as we go international.
Yeah. And we like to think that here in America, we have kind of the gold standard of free speech, and compared to many other places on earth, that we are perhaps at the top of the pile in that respect. But I think it was our second U.S. president enacted the, the Alien and Sedition Acts, which basically made it a crime to speak against your government. We literally can't say, well, it can't happen here because it already has at some point in our history.
Sure. But what I'm saying is I think we all agree that being in the political debate like this is fine. But if you extend that to internationally, I'm just saying it gets very murky. But let's talk about, I think some in Congress, somebody asked him if this kind of bias was intentionally built into the algorithm. And that is just not how it works. I don't think any engineer would do that. It would be like a very big distraction of what you're trying to do when you're trying to build these algorithms, try to pick out the offending sites, because that's a hard enough problem in and of itself. And if this were literally what they're doing, there would be a whistleblower. So I just don't think there are multiple, actually. So I don't think that that's the issue at all. I agree with Mark Zuckerberg here. I think that it was what he called an enforcement error. That really means it was a human error, right? But what is a human error here? Is it someone with differing perceptions of what should and shouldn't be? Is it? I happen to think that it's probably what we talked about last time. It's the Nassim Taleb minority rule, where there was a small group of people, flagging the heck out of these videos. If you get a small group of people who are willing to go to distance and willing to pool all their resources together and downvote a single target, I think that that minority group, whoever it is, if it's just, enemies of X, should be able to take down X pretty easily.
Should be or are able to?
Are. Like, okay. Well, it should be in terms
case in
of
point, that, any online poll you've ever seen, because once somebody sees it and they send a link out, it's really easy to swing that in whatever direction you want just by getting people to come out of the woodwork for you.
Oh, yeah. And the people, right. Online, it's the same thing with online polls. That is a very good observation. It's very hard to take those seriously. It's basically like who on Twitter cares. Like if it's a Twitter poll, it's like who on Twitter cares more about this issue, not necessarily what the majority would say. Now, do you think it's one of those issues where it's the users themselves who have been flagging it, or is it the enforcers on the other end?
That's a good question, because it's unclear to me from the way he described it whether so clearly there is a quote unquote human in the loop at Facebook who was involved in this decision. Whether it was a human reviewing user complaints and user flags, or if it was a human reviewing some sort of AI that was reviewing content and brought it to the attention of a human user. But somehow it ended up on this content checker's desk, and they clicked to disable or shut it down or demonetize it or whatever the action taken against this particular channel was. And which My perspective on this is it's a very different human error than what we were talking about in episode zero, episode one, with the Hawaiian incoming ballistic missile false alarm. That from what it's been described, was a human error in that somebody clicked the wrong button. Not that somebody thought they were doing the right thing, and it turned out later that they had made a poor decision, perhaps based on bad information or because their criteria was not as well designed as it should have been. But they completely understood what they were doing. Whereas in Hawaii, it sounds like the person didn't realize that's what they were doing.
Well, let me give you an example from some of the things that we face at Foursquare that could have led up to it. So we have a bunch of kind of what could be called like right-wing spam ads that sometimes make their way into the system that we have to get rid of. Ironically, a lot of these ads come from Facebook. But it would be you'd check into your local coffee shop and you just get like a way over the top. If this were 2 years ago, like Obama set to declare himself dictator of the world, type of stuff. Nobody wants to hear that stuff when they're just trying to enjoy their coffee. And so, we try to filter out those ads. And so you have an epidemic of those ads that we're used to seeing. You also have a lot of people who work in tech who have kind of a left-leaning point of view, so they're particularly annoyed by those types of ads. So you can kind of see a situation where when something gets flagged to that effect, you sort of make an assumption as to what it is without looking into it too carefully.
Yeah, it's easy to start lumping things together.
Yeah. And so I mean, I don't know how to deal with this. Can you have like a group diverse enough to check these by committee, which seems kind of crazy?
Well, right. Yeah. And if you're trying to use a wide spread of diversity to inoculate yourself against these kinds of failures, now that implies that you're going to have people double, triple, quadruple checking these decisions to make sure that one person doesn't allow their personal bias to flow into it. And I don't know how realistic that's going to be.
If you want to make your one goal, we want to make sure that we don't offend the Republicans, and we want to make sure that we don't offend the Democrats. And so we're going to have kind of a bipartisan look at this. Then I think if that's the one problem that you're focused on solving, you could probably solve that one problem by having like two sides of the coin. But the coin
right,
is
but,
not
but by focusing on that, you're necessarily excluding other possible spins on
oh,
it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And how do you get all the various degrees of opinions from all over the world? Yeah. And the fact that all these, the so-called two sides in America have really multiple different sides, and it's,
right.
And that's happening all over the world in different ways in every country. So,
And if you have a multi-layer review process where someone's making a decision and then somebody's, you know, double or like I said, triple, quadruple checking it to make sure that they haven't miscalled it. What is your, I guess default is not the right term, but in, you know, for example, in baseball, the tie goes to the runner. So if your layers of decision making here disagree, what is the position that you default to? Do you default to letting the information through? Do you default to if we can't come to a decision, we block it? Because there's the outcomes of that are fundamentally different, and it's based on a very different philosophy of what your role is in this yeah. information space and community.
Well, it sounds like you would have several different committees, each of which could let the information go through. But it sounds like a nightmare to manage, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't want to have to design or run anything like that.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe we could take a fat tail perspective, you know. Now, Diamond and Silk, they're pretty popular, as I understand it. I don't have their numbers in front of me. But I think the question is, if you have a group of, if you want to look at a group of, you know, podcasters or video makers or posters or whatever, there's like the fat tail of people who don't have a lot of listeners. That's me for now. But there's also a group of people who are very popular. And that group is pretty small. So probably for that group, you can, you know, put a lot of resources towards being fair to that group. But then is that fair overall? And is that, you know, if you kind of spend more resources in ensuring that the big guys are treated fairly, are not booted unfairly, then again, you're becoming a platform for the incumbents, essentially.
Right. Yeah. It's Facebook or YouTube or whatever platform it is, places where the participants, the content generators who are big money makers for them get their way and they cater to them, or is a place where the consumers, the users, are the ones they're catering to.
Yeah.
And are those two aligned or are they not? And then of course, if once you decide who your primary audience is, how do you protect the kind of minority view, minority stake?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We want our listeners to weigh in. If you do have a point of view on this, we can talk about it on the air, localmaxradio@gmail.com. I want to go through to one more thing that Mark Zuckerberg said that I found very interesting, something that they're trying to do at Facebook that I think is going to be much easier said than done. So let me.
Well, while you're pulling that up, one
I have to put in my password in my locked here. All right, I've got it.
Well, yes. I hope it was a very secure password with what's the current standard now? It's you need characters and letters, numbers, uppercase, lowercase, special characters. No spaces.
I'm not giving you anything about my password. Good thing this is an audio show. I hope nobody gets it by like listening to what keys.
The sound of the keys.
Yeah. I'm going to have to edit that out. If that sound made it in. All right. Do you have one more thing to say? Or do you want to listen to it?
So we've talked a little bit about this already, but I thought it was particularly interesting that when one of the congressmen asked him about the type of censorship that Facebook is doing, and he very uncomfortably, but very, very, very assertively said that, well, I don't see what we do as censorship. Right. And that's kind of gilding the lily there. I think what they're doing absolutely is censorship, but they feel like it's the right kind of censorship. And so they shouldn't be tarred with that dirty word.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's
because we all agree that there are some things that, well, maybe we don't all agree, but all the people in that room, there are some things they agree should be censored. And right. I don't think anyone was going to come out and say, well, you've been doing a great job filtering out all of that ISIS propaganda, but you shouldn't be, because they deserve a voice too. There was nobody in that room who was going to take that stance.
Yeah.
But there are certainly people out there who would. Yeah. They just aren't sitting on that committee in Congress.
Right. I understand why he said it in that way. I think that, you know, I don't think
it makes him seem a little slimy that he was working the terminology like that. But then again, given his company in that room.
Yeah, you know as well as I, he can't say, well, this is our censorship strategy.
Yeah, well, and they didn't even get into the whole discussion about what they may or may not be doing to cooperate with the Chinese, you know, the Great Firewall of China, so that they can play in that market, because they want all 1 billion of those users.
Yeah, I know nothing about what
they're doing there. It's certainly an interesting topic, but yeah, I'm not prepared to discuss it in any detail.
Yeah, like I said, in every country, they're going to not only have to deal with the government, but the local sensibilities as well. Yeah. So, all right. So let's hear the philosophical shift.
I would say that we're going through a broader philosophical shift in how we approach our responsibility as a company. For the first 10 or 12 years of the company, I viewed our responsibility as primarily building tools that if we could put those tools in people's hands, then that would empower people to do good things. What I think we've learned now across a number of issues, not just data privacy, but also fake news and foreign interference in elections, is that we need to take a more proactive role and a broader view of our responsibility. It's not enough to just build tools. We need to make sure that they're used for good. And that means that we need to now take a more active view in policing the ecosystem and in watching and kind of looking out and making sure that all of the members in our community are using these tools in a way that's going to be good and healthy.
All right, I'm going to stop it there to summarize what he just said. The old way of thinking was we're going to build tools that are useful to people. We're going to put them out there and they could use it however they want. But the new sensibility is, no, we also have to consider how these tools are being used. Then if they're not being used in the way we think they should be used, or they're not being used for, you know, what we see as good, then we have to remove these tools from the wrong hands. And so I think this is, again, easier said than done. It sounds good, but for the same reason that this hate speech issue is sort of a very, very, very difficult problem, I think what he's talking about here is also a very difficult problem.
Well, and this isn't a new problem. It's something we've been hearing about for over a decade, because it gets back to the whole revolution in media rights. You constantly hear the early digital music providers, they weren't really digital music providers, but they were the sources we were getting our digital music from. So your Napsters and the series of successors there, as well as things like the developers of Torrents and BitTorrent and the Pirate Bay. So we're creating a platform that enables users to share data, and it has legitimate uses. It just so happens that some people are using it to share things that maybe they shouldn't be, but that's not our responsibility as the platform provider. We simply provide the platform, and the users are responsible for any data they upload or download from that system. And for a long time, Facebook was taking that same approach, and YouTube and other sites that, yeah, we can't possibly be expected to police what the users put up there. We're not generating that content. We're simply the platform on which they share it. And it sounds like those days are over.
Oh, yeah. For these types of platforms, absolutely. I feel like they have the power to police or at least to attempt to police their platforms. And I think now they are kind of expected to do that. But this whole idea sort of clashes with what could be called the new internet that's being built. I guess it's kind of funny because I don't know if you've been watching Silicon Valley, but that whole thing is about building the new internet. But the new internet that I talk about is the whole crypto network idea, like Bitcoin. And well, if you go back to Tor, Tor and onion routing, that's a technology that I believe was developed at the Department of Defense to hide where you are online. And now that it's out there, you can't stop anyone from using this tool. Same goes with these cryptocurrencies. It's out there, and just by design, you can't stop anyone from using it. It's not like somebody's unwilling to try. It's that you literally can't.
Yeah, you can't unring the bell, so to speak, and particularly with something that is decentralized. So, in the case of Tor, in the case of cryptocurrency, this is absolutely true because it's not like you can issue a court order and show up at Facebook and say, we're shutting you down, pull the plug on all your servers. That could happen, but you can't do that to Bitcoin. You can't do that to the Tor network. You can't do that with certain types of cryptography, because once the algorithm has been put out there in the world and it's not sitting in a single place, somebody's copied it and it's been exported, you can't remove that from the knowledge base.
Yeah. So in the next decade, it seems to me that these social media platforms, and I think we agree when it comes to like things like Facebook and Twitter and all that, they're going to be living in a strategy where they're trying to police their tools. But then you're also going to have a bunch of developers intentionally developing unpoliceable tools. I actually read an anti-Bitcoin article the other day, and I think it ended with, it's Somalia on purpose or something like that. But it's one of these articles that, make me more bullish on it. It's just like I said, Krugman's article back in 2013 when I was talking about it, when he was like, my pieces of paper are fine, thank you very much. It's like such a ridiculous argument that it makes me like it more.
There are some people, when they argue against you, it only makes you more confident, because if they disagree with me, I must be right.
Yeah, but coming back to the point, you have these intentionally unpoliceable tools competing against these tools that are going to be policed by armies of engineers and labelers and people who are trying to understand different cultures. And we're going to have kind of a clash of civilizations here. And the market, or the course of time, is going to sort out where these two types of platforms live in relationship to each other. And I think that's something that is, we'll sort of find out how that goes in the next 10 years, but that'll be some of the most interesting developments that are coming up. I don't want to speculate on how this turns out. This is one thing where I'm literally throwing up my hands and having no idea, but I will speculate that they will both be living side by side in 10 years.
Yeah, I think it absolutely will. In a lot of ways, you could draw some parallels to content generation and the internet and the internet now and the cable and network worlds previously, that the shift to a lot of innovative new content and content that wouldn't be allowed on television networks to thriving in an internet world hasn't meant that your network television and cable networks have dried up and gone away. They're still there, and they're still playing a very important role, even if they are regulated by the FCC and many other government as well as self-regulatory restrictions. They're still alive and perhaps not thriving, but they're doing just fine. However, there's a whole new piece of medium that's grown up alongside that and taken advantage of a lot of the things that didn't have a place in the old medium. And I think we're going to see another round of that in terms of this centralized, decentralized paradigm that you've talked about before.
Yeah. But what's going to happen now if Congress is upset or there's some outrage, if people misuse these tools that are fundamentally uncensorable, like what is going to be the reaction? Like, are we going to get a similar reaction and then people are going to be stomping their feet that there's nothing they could do about it? Or what is going to be, or are people just going to come to terms with it and it's going to be sort of a, well, this is how it is, but you want to go on Facebook and they're policed a little better, so you should go on Facebook for that.
You know, probably know more about what I'm going to mention next than I do, so maybe you can fill me and the listeners in.
Okay.
I believe there was in China a backlash against Bitcoin, and they did they outlaw the trading or shut down exchanges?
I don't know. China? I know what the memes say. The memes say that like China plans to ban Bitcoin, and then the price goes down, and then they all buy, and then it's like, oh, we didn't buy Bitcoin anymore. They usually they have like the South Park guy meme. When you've only gotten your news through memes, I'm not.
Well, it's the Daily Show problem.
I've only got my news. Yeah, so I'm not very confident in my knowledge of the situation.
But so whether it is true or not, it's setting forth a case of there is a government that feels threatened by the way a certain tool is being used, and they attempt to shut it down or to exert some control over it. But fundamentally, it's not something that can be shut down or controlled in that fashion. What's the outcome there? And I don't think the story is done being written on that. I think if Bitcoin continues to and other cryptocurrencies continue to increase their influence, you are going to see organized governments trying to not necessarily shut it down, but exert more control over it through some sort of regulatory action. And I don't know how that's going to play out.
Sure, it's a process of trying and begrudging acceptance. But that actually reminds me of another recent article that I read coming out of China where, when Kim Jong-un came to China, the Chinese government actually censored, they banned people from typing Kim Jong-un on the internet. I don't know how they do that on the whole internet. I don't know. But you can't type those characters in because they didn't want people, mentioning his name as he was coming through for diplomatic reasons. So as I read it, a bunch of Chinese people started writing what could be translated as fatty on the train instead of Kim Jong-un as a way to get around the censors. And it actually got around. It was actually ended up being uncensored, which is crazy. So they can't even solve the problem, even though they have the power to censor out any phrase. People are just smart enough to come up with another phrase, which seems like it backfired because it doesn't sound very diplomatic. If you
censorship is talking about is a very blunt tool, and so you can use it to hammer away at things, but it's not necessarily going to have the desired effect.
Yeah. All right. So that's all I have to say on that issue. I think the book is yet unwritten on this, and we're just going to have to, this is one reason for starting this podcast. We're going to have to keep exploring this and see how it goes over the next
Before we sign off, we've been talking a lot about, you said you thought Zuckerberg did as well as could be expected in his testimony. What is your faith in, perhaps not necessarily the narrow question of Facebook solving this problem, because I from what we've said, I think you're saying I'm going to pose it as a much broader question. Facebook, buy or sell? Would given the outcome of these hearings, would you be comfortable investing in Facebook stock, or would you hedge against it? And looking at the long term, not the immediate short term.
Yeah, I think that they kind of remind me of Microsoft in 2000, where everybody, because he was accused of being a monopolist in there, which I don't think they are. Where they're accused of being a monopoly, but they're really not. It's really a temporary situation where they seem very dominant. But, that being said, Microsoft, I think, is still much more valuable today than it was back in 2000. Am I wrong about that? So I think they're going to continue to grow, maybe just not at the pace that they were, but they're going to become a much more.
I can't answer the question on Microsoft's valuation, but I can say that the Microsoft today is a very different company than it was then, because they've been forced to adapt in some dramatic ways, which Which to say that Facebook will not adapt in dramatic ways, I think would be a foolish assumption.
Yes, I would say hold. That's the same thing as I said yesterday, as I said last week when I was trying to figure out where Facebook was in its life cycle. I said safe to assume somewhere in the middle. So why don't I stick with that? I would say hold on Facebook.
You said hold. Now for clarification, do you own any current shares in Facebook that you wish to disclose to our viewing audience?
Not that I know of. I don't think so.
Me either, unless it's something that I hold in like an index fund.
Right, exactly. It's possible.
So that covers our butts with the FCC or is it the FTC that we're not giving any advice which is intended to inflate our personal fortunes.
Are you legally saving my ass here? Is that what's happening? Because I had no idea about it.
I'm honestly not sure whether we are required to make such a disclosure or not, but it has been done.
Okay, so we better do it just to keep.
Also, we are not lawyers. If you require a lawyer, consult one who is qualified in the field you require.
Yeah. If you require a podcaster, call me. Okay, is that it? I think that's about it, right?
I think so.
All right, thanks a lot. Let's. Maybe you'll come back on to see what kind of responses we get on localmaxradio.com. And thanks for your help.
Yeah, I look forward to being back.
By the way, I should mention that Aaron quit Facebook almost entirely. I haven't. I'm still on Facebook. I'm big on Facebook. But I feel like we should have pointed that out in terms of full disclosure. By the way, that's why you can't find Aaron anywhere. It's like he doesn't exist, like a ghost in the digital realm. Anyway, I'm going to New Haven this week to speak at Yale, and I'll push out an episode if I can, if the technology cooperates. And then I'm going to San Francisco, where I have some product-based interviews expected. So some interesting stuff, a lot of bot-related stuff. So subscribe to The Local Maximum and stay tuned for that. That's the show. If you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. If you want to keep up, remember to follow The Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account, @MaxClark. Have a great week.
Feel, feel the power.
She said, I don't care what you say. You're gonna see me shine someday.
What you're saying is that we are a danger yeah. to our community. Is that's what you're saying? I mean, I don't get that. It's offensive. It's appalling. I look at this as discrimination. I look at this as freedom of speech. What about our freedom of speech as a censorship? Censoring our voices.
So I'd like to ask you, do you subjectively manipulate your algorithms to prioritize or censor speech?